Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Dad?
Well, hello there, Taylor.
How you feeling today?
Well, just dealing with the wacky weather. One day, at one minute it's raining, then it's sleeting, then it's snowing, and then there's this clear sunshine coming out of the skies. You just wait 15 minutes in West Virginia, and it's liable to change.
That's not really normal, though, right? Like, usually, this year, seasons.
Well, this year, anything's normal. I mean, or everything's abnormal. I don't know which.
Has the weather just fallen in line with the unhingedness of the world?
Yeah, it's just said, hell with it. Nobody else is doing what they're supposed to do. I'm not either.
Oh, man. Yeah, I heard you all got snow, and I braced for it because we usually get your weather. We get your secondhand weather. So whatever you get, we get it like 2 days later and about 10 degrees colder usually. But somehow that didn't work out that way. It was cold today, but it was not snow.
Yeah, the 21st, we wake up in the morning and look out. And I won't say there was an inch on the ground, but the whole ground was coated. And it was continuing to snow. It told us the snow was going to end by 7 a.m., but it snowed off and on all day. On the 21st of April, that's almost May.
I mean... Yeah, I say we've had like the Easter snowstorms up here in New York before. That's not out of the possibility. But
it's been a couple weeks since Easter.
Well, and it's also been consistently nice up here. Usually, once it settles in, you're good. You know, you get the back and forth days, but once you get that first string of weeks where it's like above 55, 60 degrees, it stays that way.
Well, here's what's weird though. On Tuesday, it was 75 degrees here. We were out. We had rehearsal at the park, and we were there until 8:30, 9 o'clock at night in short sleeve shirts. And you wake up the next morning with snow on the ground. Man. And the high for the day is like 39.
Well, you know what this type of weather would be terrible for?
What's that?
Growing wine grapes.
Well, yes, you need consistent weather. You don't need these kind of ins and outs and freezes and thaws.
No. Well, and that brings us to the topic that we picked for today.
Oh, that's a good transition there, Tay. Good job.
Right? Yeah, it's made even better when you point it out. today I wanted to talk about it's a paradox, really, because it's the... universally enjoyed, but also much maligned, wine varietal that is Merlot.
Merlot.
Old Merlot. So, yeah. There's a long history with Merlot. It's grown around the world, but it also kind of has a certain, reputation as being kind of a less respectable wine, which comes from... a couple different places. So, I don't know. Let's get into it.
All right. Well, let's get into it.
All right. So, now, of course, first and foremost, what is Merlot? As we've mentioned before, wine names sometimes come from a place of origin. Sometimes they come from just a general category, like we did with Rosé. But in this case, it is the grape itself that gives us the name. So Merlot wine comes from Merlot grapes. It's the name of the grape. It's the name of the wine. Easy. Hmm.
Now, that makes sense. I can follow that logic.
Now, Merlot grapes can be used, and they are often used, as a popular blending grape. So... for instance, they play a major part in a lot of other wines, but the biggest is probably Bordeaux. So a percentage of Bordeaux wine is Merlot wine, if that makes sense. Bordeaux is named for a region. Bordeaux wine comes from the Bordeaux region of France. What goes in that bottle of Bordeaux is a certain blend of a certain number of grapes, one of which is Merlot.
And Merlot was one of the most popular ones grown in the Bordeaux region.
Mm-hmm. Even now, it's over 50% of what of the grapes that are grown in Bordeaux. Now, the grape itself is an offspring of Cabernet Franc and another much more obscure wine, which is the Magdalene Noire de Chauhant.
Easy for you to say.
Not easy for me to say. I'm sorry to any French person listening. And it's closely related to the Malbec and the Cabernet Sauvignon grapes, so they're kind of like half siblings. So it's in a very prominent family. Merlot grapes get their name from a diminutive of Merle, which is or blackbird in French, named possibly for the fact that the birds like to dine on the Merlot grapes, but also the birds themselves, they're blackbirds, the color, which correlates to the grapes themselves, which are a deep blue-black color. They typically produce a lower acid and a higher sugar content. They have a delicate skin that yields less tannins than many in their family, yet they can grow in a wide variety of soils and climates. Merlot grapes are the second most cultivated wine grape in the world, second only to Cabernet Sauvignon. And it can be found, obviously, throughout Europe, but also everywhere from, like, Canada to Mexico to India to China, South Africa, Argentina, Japan. Pretty much everywhere that is somewhat temperate, someone is given a go at growing Merlot.
They'll pretty much grow anywhere. They're kind of like weeds. You throw it in the ground and they'll grow.
Yes. Now, we're going to get into this a bit more in a minute, but just because it grows doesn't mean it grows well. But yes, it can grow in a lot of different climates. Now, as far as the wine goes, the wine is made using the whole grape and skin. So they carefully remove all the stems. They don't want to add that excess bitterness. And then the skin on grape is fermented the whole process gives it that deep red hue. And also that thin skin offers up less tannin, so you get less astringency than other grapes. And that higher sugar leads to a wine that has a higher alcohol content generally, and a sweeter flavor. Merlot is typically stored in oak after fermentation, anywhere from 8 months to a year. And once in the bottle, it can continue to age for 3 to 5 years before the flavor starts to suffer. So that idea that like a wine can just sit on your shelf, especially a red wine, can sit on your shelf and just get better decade after decade, that's not really true. Most wine varietals have like an age timeline you want to stick around. And for Merlot, it's a little bit younger than some. You know, that 3 to 5 years, that's when you're going to hit your sweet spot. Any more than that, and you might have vinegar.
Well, when we get a bottle of wine, it doesn't last very long. I can tell you that.
I've never kept I've aged some red wine for maybe a week.
Yeah, we don't have a wine cellar, so when we buy a bottle of wine, it's for drinking purposes. It might survive till the next weekend, but that's about it.
Yeah, well, and you know, to speak on the temperature of how you should drink Merlot, like a lot of red wines, your average interior of like an air-conditioned house, that bottle still is not going to get quite cold enough as what you should both store it at or drink it at, really. So, you know, if you're going to age wine, you should have some sort of, you can buy those like little tabletop dudes that keep like temperature regulations slightly lower than room temperature, which is good. And if you're going to drink it, you know, throwing it in the fridge for 10 minutes before you open it is going to actually present itself better than if it was at a warmer temperature.
You know, it's funny you should mention that. We have that little wine fridge that we have sitting on top of the beer fridge. Yeah. And when I thought there was something wrong with it, when I tried to adjust the temperature on it, it will only go down to 50 degrees. It's not like a regular refrigerator or something like that where you're going to keep things, you know, above freezing but pretty cold. So it only goes down to 50. So I guess that's what it's looking for, is things like mm-hmm. Merlot that needs to be cooler than room temperature but not cold.
Well, and that's, you know, this is by no means an across-the-board statement, because there are some, specifically white wines, that you do want to drink very cold. That's how they're most pleasurable. But by and large, the way, like, keeping a white wine refrigerated or keeping a red wine at room temperature is not optimal. Like, there's the old adage, like, throw a red wine in the fridge for 10 minutes, take a white wine out of the fridge for 10 minutes before you drink it. Because a lot of our preferred wine drinking temperatures come from before we had refrigeration and before we had, you know, like interior air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And so you have this more like 50, 60 degrees kind of safe space where wine was consumed and also like opens up the best, is most pleasurable. So that's like, you know, that's a good, that fridge is doing on both sides. It's keeping your white wines, you know, chill enough to consume, but not so cold that like you're going to lose some flavors, and your red wines chill enough that like, you know, you don't want them to warm up too much. They taste a little bit too like boozy, but you want them to have that slight bit of crisp on them.
Hmm. See, I thought there was something wrong with it. I was expecting to be like the beer fridge. Beer fridge would keep it good and cold.
No, it's just a very, it's a tighter range of temperatures for most red and white wines that you want to drink them in.
Well, it's good to know that my wine fridge isn't broken because I've been using it for 8 years or something.
No, no, it's all right. I've utilized that wine fridge before. It's working fine. There are two general styles that Merlot wine is made in. There's the New World style, which focuses on later harvest grapes. So, you know, what does that mean? Well, very simply, grape stays on the vine longer. It gets a darker skin, so that's going to provide a richer pigment and slightly more tannins, and it's also going to have more sugar content inside that little grape. So, late harvest wine, that's New World Merlot, and that's going to give you more sugar, thus more alcohol, fuller body, darker color, richer fruit flavors. Now, the more traditional style, which is the second style, is the Bordeaux style of Merlot. And you can kind of, it's how they would have made Merlot to fit in a blend of Bordeaux. And those are harvested slightly earlier to preserve some acidity. They have less fermentable sugar, thus a generally lower in alcohol, and registers more medium body with lighter fruit notes, and they have the possibility of developing some like grassy, leafy, vegetal notes as well.
And is that not as sweet?
Not as sweet, yep. Yeah, so your grape is going to develop less sugar, so you've got less sugar to ferment, so you've got less alcohol and less sugar in the final product.
All right.
Yeah. Now, a little bit of history for the wine. The earliest mention we have of Merlot grapes come to us from France, of course, in 1784 in the notes of a Bordeaux official who was noting the grapes in a particularly excellent bottle of Bordeaux. He mentioned Merlot as one of them. It was embraced in French winemaking throughout the 18th century as kind of the perfect counterpoint to Cabernet Sauvignon in Bordeaux wine. So Merlot's softer tannins and sweeter fruits balance the boldness and the astringency of Cabernet Sauvignon. And it's still the most grown grape in France. In Bordeaux, as we mentioned, it accounts for half the vineyards. And as a blend, most styles of Bordeaux average around 25% Merlot, though some have upwards of 60 to 80% Merlot. There are some very coveted, rare, like expensive Bordeaux that have almost entirely Merlot in them. So very respected in French winemaking. But it wasn't consumed on its own until it spread outside of France, which happened around the 19th century.
Well, and they also use it to bring down the expense of some fancier wines. And when they blend it together, because Merlot isn't as expensive.
Well, it's less temperamental. So, you know, I mean, that's true. But I wouldn't say it's not about like expense or quality. It's just that Merlot is a little bit hardier. So you probably could have a bigger yield of Merlot. Now, as Merlot spread throughout Europe, it grew in popularity for its easy cultivation. But it found particular popularity in Italy, who both worked it into blends and discovered the satisfaction of drinking it solo. Merlot arrived in California in the mid-1900s and helped establish Washington State as a viable winemaking territory in the 80s. So, you know, it was long believed that Washington was a little too cold. California had already been establishing its wine-growing regions. Washington State was like, it's a little too cold. You can't really make good wine up there. And the hardiness of Merlot helped put Washington State on the map, which, of course, today it's an amazing winemaking region. Like Washington State is known for its wines, but Merlot was really the wine that helped cement that in the 80s.
Hmm.
But it wasn't until the 90s that Merlot really caught its stride. And this is where the story of Merlot in the States is really a fascinating look at how our palates can be influenced by the media we consume.
Mm-hmm.
So it all started with a segment that aired in 1991 on the news magazine TV show 60 Minutes.
I know that. It's got the stopwatch there.
It is still on, right? Like, I haven't had cable in a really long time, but I grew up with 60 Minutes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's still on. They've turned over a lot of the hosts because it's been on so long. The ones that were on there originally are dead now, and they got a lot of new ones.
I was gonna say, it's been on for a while. Well, so in 91, they ran a segment on the supposed French paradox. This idea that the French people could eat cheese and meat and bread and drink all this red wine and yet maintain healthfulness, while at the time, you know, Americans were just, I mean, we're talking about the late 80s, early 90s. Americans were fully engulfed in, like, toxic diet culture. And so why could the French behave this way, and yet we were struggling with all of these issues in the States? And, you know, the takeaway from that could have been, I mean, for one thing, the French paradox has been largely, you know, it's been kind of picked apart over time by focusing on the fact that, like, hey, we don't measure healthfulness the same way in America as in France. So we can't really compare these statistics the way that that original study did. Also, like, you know, there are factors that do come into play about how, you know, it's customary in France, like the quality of your food, how it's both grown, how it's made, and then also how it's consumed, like giving yourself time to enjoy it, like focusing on quality, caring about consuming things that are made well and good for you. Like, there's a focus on that. What, none of that was taken into the American conscience. It was just, oh, wait. So we want to be healthy. We need to drink a lot of red wine. Cool. Let's do it.
We picked up the point that we liked the most. Okay. Yes. They said it's okay to drink. It makes you healthier. And they didn't hear anything else. There were no other parts of that translated. And, you know, the fact is, a lot of these other countries being kind of, I guess, older, they had a lot of traditions built around families and meals and things like that that changed the way that, that people ate. Whereas in America, our culture has developed that everything's fast. Got to get in quick, get out, got to, you know, hurry up and get through meals. And so fast food and some of the things that became available in our culture, you know, were working against us. And we didn't look at those type of things. We looked at instead, drink wine.
Well, and that's a great point, because I think that if there is something to learn from the French paradox, it is just that. It's that, you know, there is a lot of purposeful joy and indulgence that's meant to be a part of a meal in a lot of other cultures, where in America, it's like, it's shameful, right? Sitting down and like having dinner for 2 hours, just relaxing, talking with your family, spending time, like, you could be being productive.
Yeah.
You know? Like, stopping in the middle of the workday to have like an hour sit down to enjoy yourself. That's not a thing. That's not a thing we do. That's the useful part of what this study could have provided us with.
Yeah. You know, because it's like somebody presented the question, if there was a pill that you could take and you could just take that pill and not have to eat, would you do it? Well, there's something about the act of sitting down and sharing a meal with other people that humanizes us. So, no, I would not be in favor of that. As convenient as that may sound and easy as it would be, like if assuming it maintained health, it still would not be a desirable thing to do. I prefer eating.
Well, but I think if you have a cultural consciousness that's centered around productivity, there are a lot of people that might answer yes or feel that they're supposed to answer yes to that question, because, you know, any amount of personal satisfaction or indulgence or enjoyment that takes away from your productivity is kind of frowned upon. Like, you know, like we replaced enjoyment with shame in our culture somehow. We did that. So, you know, and the irony is that what happens in response to this 60 Minutes piece. So a bunch of people in America start buying red wine, right? We're all going to go drink red wine. And why did they pick Merlot? Because all red wines shot up at this point, but Merlot in particular really dominated. The supposition is twofold. One is that this is kind of silly, but it's probably true. It's easier to pronounce than some of its competitors. People could say Merlot. The other, which is far more of a factor, is that Merlot, as we mentioned, was very easy to grow. So wine producers trying to meet this demand just started planting Merlot everywhere. Like, that's what, we're just going to give you a bunch of Merlot because you want a bunch of red wine and we can do this. And I mean, that's kind of the sad thing about this is what ends up happening is Merlot becomes sort of the fast food of wine. We produce a bunch of it. Yeah, and we don't, but you know, just because a grape can grow anywhere doesn't mean it's good anywhere. And it doesn't mean it doesn't need attention. It doesn't mean it doesn't need care. You know, like, it's kind of like, I think yes, it's a hardy grape in essence of it won't die on the vine, but what ends up in the bottle still requires all of the care that you would put into traditional winemaking. So we end up with this glut of crappy Merlot.
And it's like anything else that grows out of the ground. It's made up out of the things that are in the ground. I mean, that
exactly.
It all goes into it. All soil is not the same. So you have to be careful where you plant it and what's involved in it to do that. If you're, if you ignore that, then you're not going to end up with the same thing.
Well, and that's very true, because Merlot has this sort of softer quality to it. It very much it takes on and expresses the soil, the water, the climate that it's grown in. And if you're not paying attention to those things or balancing those things out with how you ferment it, how you age it, you will end up with bad wine. So we ended up with a glut of bad wine, bad Merlot, moving into the 2000s.
And that started people talking bad about it.
Yes, which sort of brings us to our next cultural touchstone, that the 2004 movie Sideways, starring Paul Giamatti and
Virginia Madsen, Sandra Oh, and Thomas Hayden Church.
Thomas Hayden Church. I was about to call him the guy from that. What was that? There was a sitcom that I used to watch him on. That Wings. Do you remember that?
Was he on Wings?
Wasn't he on Wings? Am I wrong?
I didn't think so, but he could have been. The one guy is more recognizable to me. I mean, maybe he was. I never really watched Wings. I would see it either coming on after something I watched or going off before something I watched. But I never really watched it, per se. I know it lasted a while.
Yeah, he was on Wings. Okay, I'm not wrong.
Well, that shows you how little I watched it. I remember the one guy from it, but I don't even remember his name.
I had a babysitting gig back in like high school, and that was what was on TV when I was just babysitting these two children, and I would watch a lot of Wings. And I really liked his character, so I liked seeing him in a movie. But
well, I guess Sandra Oh got her start there before Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good. It was a won a bunch of Oscars. The plot of Sideways is, I don't know, two dudes. One is about to be married. One is waiting to see if his book is going to get published or not. They go up to wine country in California for a week to sort of, bachelor party it up. And I don't know, sort of life ensues, I guess. They drink a lot of wine. They talk about wine a lot. Paul Giamatti's character is very much like a big wine guy.
Yeah, there's a romance portion of it and stuff, but we're more interested in the wine part. We don't care about the romance stuff that's involved there. But Giamatti was very invested in wine and very, very adamant in what he liked and didn't like. And he even saw a lot of things in wine and winemaking that he attached to lessons to learn in life.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it is. There is a lot of, like, there's stuff about the movie that I don't think plays well today. Like, the one dude is like, he's about to get married, but he's actively cheating on his bride to be. Like, Paul Giamatti's character is very like, I think he's a good dude, but he's also pretty, he makes some pretty poor decisions here and there. And like, the wine element I think is really beautiful because it does, there are some dialogues around winemaking and the respect that goes into it and the thought that goes into it and the life of wine that are really beautiful. And I think that the central sort of idea behind it is kind of, you know, that Paul Giamatti's character who loves Pinot Noir, and he kind of compares himself. He doesn't compare himself to Pinot Noir, but the script is clearly trying to make you draw the comparison of him and Pinot Noir as being, you know, like thin skin, temperamental, in need of constant care and attention, but producing this perfect, you know, transcendent product if you just treat it right. Like, that's sort of a dialogue he gives. So there's a lot of beautiful metaphors with wine. Whereas then, like, Jack, his friend, who's very gregarious and outgoing, but, you know, the one that's cheating on his wife, he's the Merlot of the movie, right? He's can survive everywhere. Is just, you know, is just a glut of this.
Well, and Paul Giamatti also, he's still bitter over the divorce that he had from his wife. That's kind of what he's going to, too. I think he's saying that if his ex-wife had treated him with the way that, like, Pinot Noir grapes are treated, that he would have found the best version of him.
Right.
That she didn't take good care of him, and he's kind of resentful of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a movie with flaws, but it's ultimately, I think, a good movie, especially if you're into wine. I think it's a very good movie. But on the wine industry as a whole, it got fabled to have a bigger effect than it actually had. I will say that. So it was known as the sideways effect, and that Merlot was just destroyed in sales because at one point in the movie, Paul Giamatti's character talks about how he, you know, he won't drink Merlot, that basically Merlot is just garbage wine. And like I said, like him going on that tirade, I mean, it's inferred that it was a wine that his previous wife liked to drink, but his reasonings for it are more that it's like, you know, it's just not as respectable as other wines. And that's not wrong for the time period we're talking in, because we are talking in this time period where Merlot would have been this not quite like respected, well-made wine. It would have just been this kind of, you know, easy access, very drinkable, like thoughtless wine that was being produced in mass.
So a lot of the media jumped to the conclusion because of this movie, Merlot sales were falling off, and they're saying it was because of the movie, when in fact, if you look back a few years, they had already started dropping off, and it just continued to drop off at the same rate it already was before the movie, but the movie was credited with it.
Exactly. And now, there was an effect on the wine industry from this movie that I think you can register, but it's actually a positive effect. And that's
right.
Pinot Noir, the grape that Paul Giamatti's character just talks at length about how great it is. Pinot Noir sales increased massively, like 16% after the movie's release. And like by now it's like 150% sales increase. It became the second most popular grown grape in California. So it didn't really kill Merlot, but it did. It probably led a fair amount of Merlot drinkers to try out Pinot Noir, and it led a lot of people that didn't drink wine at all to start drinking something, and they started with Pinot Noir. So I would say it's a net positive for the wine industry.
Yeah, I would agree. And the thing that was kind of ironic is at the conclusion, that Miles Prize 1961 Cheval Blanc said that he drank that as it was actually a blend of Merlot and Cabernet Franc. Well, and that was the one that he praised, that was such a great wine, but it had a Merlot in it.
Right. Well, and Cabernet Franc, like I mentioned, that's the granddaddy of, or the father of Merlot, which is also the father of a lot of grapes. But it's actually a really great scene. He drinks it in a fast food restaurant. But I think that, you know, they talk about the aging thing there too, because that's a wine that the love interest he has mentions, like, that wine is probably bad, like, after this year, like, you should drink it now. And it's a whole, like, you know, it's a symbolism thing. But no, it's interesting to think of the cultural effect. How much of our palates, as you mentioned, we've talked about a couple episodes where we've talked about how what's cool presented to us in the media so easily affects how we drink, and then that's an entire, like, livelihoods and industries that are affected by this. And I don't know. I mean, when it opens up your palate to try something new, I think that's great. When it tells you that you can't drink something anymore because it's bad, I think that's bad.
But like mojitos and rosé both had their periods where they were bashed by different people and they took a dip.
Yeah. Well, and the, you know, at the end of the day, Merlot is fine. Merlot is still, like I said, the second grown grape in the world. It's used in blends. You know, there are a lot of euphemisms for Merlot, or a lot of, you know, secret names for Merlot that people have used throughout the last couple decades to hide the fact that it's a Merlot, I guess, is sort of a selling tactic.
Well, I know that red blends are something that usually contain Merlots.
Yeah, and that's sort of a way of making something sound. It can be heavily Merlot, but it's a blend, which is funny because that's literally like Bordeaux is a deeply respected type of wine in the wine scene, but Bordeaux is a red blend that often relies heavily on Merlot.
it was developed back in those days, the 90s or the early 2000s, where they started using that more commonly, calling a wine a red blend so they wouldn't have to identify Merlot because Merlot was getting such a bad rap.
Yeah. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, and this is just, it's not any, this is just personal reflections, but that the movie focuses on this idea that, you know, Pinot Noir, oh, it's a sensitive, delicate grape that, oh, it needs all these special things to grow and that makes it special and that's Paul Giamatti's character special. But then when you actually, and Merlot is just this gregarious grape that can grow anywhere. It's like, but when you actually look at the understanding of Merlot and the history of it, it's like, no, just because it can survive anywhere doesn't mean it can thrive anywhere. And it actually needs the same gentle hand as Pinot Noir to be its best self. I think that's an interesting, I don't know how that exactly plays into the movie, but it's clear that they're drawing a comparison to like Paul Giamatti's character as the Pinot Noir and Jack as the sort of, Cabernet or the Merlot of the game. And it's like, well, maybe everybody needs the gentle hand to thrive.
Well, yeah, I think that's also, it's a difference between surviving and thriving. That Merlot may be surviving anywhere and growing grapes, but that doesn't mean it's good. So to actually thrive and be good, we need that gentle hand and care.
Well, you know, by the end of the movie, because like I said, the crux of the movie is this Jack is about to get married. He wants to go out and have a crazy week before he gets married. And he kind of plays with this idea of like, oh, maybe I could, you know, run away with this beautiful woman I've met that's so exciting. Like, maybe I don't want to get married, because he's marrying to like a rich family. And it kind of is implied like he's an out of work actor. He's kind of marrying for stability. He works for his future wife's father. Like, it's a good decision for me. But right. Like, he's making the survival decision. He's not making the thriving decision. And Paul Giamatti's character, who might be this sensitive, you know, introvert, he's writing his own novel. He's kind of living in misery and poverty because he has devoted his life to being a writer, and he's dealing with the consequences, and he's willing to keep dealing with the consequences. So like, who's the stronger of the two?
Yeah.
I don't know, but just as an aside, I also like that Paul Giamatti's character is also like an English teacher by day. And he has his class reading a separate piece, which is, I think it makes sense because the story centers on like a very outgoing, athletic guy who's best friends with a very like introverted, sort of sullen guy. And that's their friendship back and forth. And I think it makes a lot of sense for the movie. Just as if you're a literary nerd, there's that you can kind of rewatch the movie and be like, oh, the director included a reference to a separate piece in here. And now I think I understand why. Yeah. So,
well, I guess Paul Giamatti isn't doing as great these days finding roles because I see him in commercials all the time. He's in some commercial on a regular basis, and, you know.
I think he's fine. He's Paul Giamatti.
I haven't seen him in any movies or TV shows. I've just seen him in commercials, so I don't know. I thought maybe he'd fallen on hard time. Maybe he's become one of those Merlots growing in the rocks.
Absolutely not. He was in John Dies at the End. I love that movie. I love that book, and I love that movie. That wasn't too long. I mean, I guess that was a while ago, but still.
He's doing commercials now.
Why are you coming from Paul Giamatti? Hey, have you ever done a commercial, Dad, that you didn't direct for your own company?
Yeah, I did one. Okay. I was a poor injured guy, and my lawyer needed to get me some money.
I think Paul Giamatti got that sideways money and he just chilled out. And I think that's smart.
That
no,
could
he's done
be.
Other things. He's definitely done other things.
You can retire on that sideways money.
I think that's, you know what? I have nothing but respect for that man. If for nothing else, because he was in John Dies at the End. But also, he's good in this too. Well, you know, hopefully, I don't know, like, I don't know if this is to encourage you to drink Merlot, because, you know, we've explained the palate. It's not as aggressive as some red wines. It's a little bit, you know, softer on the tannins. It might be a little sweeter. Not always. It could be very dry. But I don't think, if you have a preconceived notion that Merlot is bad, I would say give it another try, because there's cheap Merlot still out there, but there's cheap every wine out there now, frankly.
Right. Yeah, just try one of the better ones. Look up, do some research and find out what's ranked as one of the better ones and drink that. I know, you know, I'm not much of a wine drinker, but when I look at a glass of wine, a deep red wine like a Merlot is always looks like something I want to drink. Like, white wine is not appealing to me. When I look at that, there's nothing about a white wine that says, ooh, come drink me. But a nice, deep red wine, that looks good. But unfortunately, I'm just not a wine drinker.
Well, I do think there's something to be said for the fact that it can grow everywhere. And it can, given the right care and love, it can be cultivated to be delicious. That's really kind of a beautiful thing, because wine does carry the terroir, the land and the air and the sea that it's surrounded by. You can really get a different Merlot from so many spots in the world that you couldn't get something more sensitive, more fussy, like, you know, mm-hmm. A well-made Merlot from all around the world is going to introduce you to flavors, unique, like, flavors to that land and that sea. But because the grape can grow there, you're going to get to experience that. So I think that is cool. I think that is very cool. I don't know if there's anything particularly valuable about something just because it's difficult.
Right. Like, that just makes it more expensive.
Right? Like, why do we devalue something just because it's, or why do we add value to something because it's harder to grow? And why do we devalue something because it, like, is easy and we mistreat it because it's easy? That's my complaint.
That's true, and it happens to people as well.
Exactly. You know, like, I don't know. I'm not a Pinot Noir. I feel very much like a Merlot. Like, I can get by everywhere, but I still need love, guys.
You know what? Maybe life lessons are like winemaking. Who knows?
Well, hey, I hope you enjoyed this little look into the history and the cultural impact of Merlot over on the video. Where, you know, of course, it's a fun challenge. Every time I bring wine to the table, I have to figure out how to make it in a way that my dad can drink it, because I know he doesn't like wine. So,
I can't help it. I try it. I just
don't.
That's
okay. That's fine. But we're gonna make a nice, you know, it's bringing, like, a topic like red wine in the spring doesn't really make sense, except it's perfect weather for sangria. Sangria is definitely a summertime drink, and I don't know about you. I prefer red sangria to white sangria. So let's see if we can't make a Cali-inspired, sideways-inspired sangria for the video. So if you're interested in that, check it out. It'll be up this weekend. Thank you, Dad, for being here, as always.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me, and I'm looking forward to it. I mean, you made the magic trick of turning rosé into frosé, and I like that. So I'm looking forward to trying your magic again on a Merlot.
Well, hopefully we can make it work. And thank you all for listening. Of course, if you want to support us, we've got a Patreon. You can check us out over there. We're Neat Boozecast. If you want to find us on social media, we are Neat Boozecast on Twitter and Instagram. If you want to email us, you can email us at neattheboozecast@gmail.com. And if you want to find us on Facebook. Dad started a Facebook group.
Neat the Boozecast.
There you go. So share your pictures of cocktails you've made or recipes you've tried. You can ask questions there too.
Or Merlot trees you've planted.
It's not really a tree.
bushes, what are they?
Merlot doesn't grow on trees.
It doesn't?
They're vines.
Oh, they're vines? See, it shows you how much I know about wine.
Right there in the name.
Hey, look, I can't drink it.
It's hanging off the tree.
I can't drink it, so I don't study it. I don't know.
Dad. All right. Well, thanks again. I have been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been...
Me. Well, so that doesn't grow just right there on the tree. You just don't pluck off the bottle, so.
No, somehow it is. That sounds like very, like, I was going to say Wizard of Oz, but I feel like that's more of like a Wizard of Oz 2 thing, right? Is that the one where the lunchboxes grow on trees?
Lunchboxes?
Remember
those really...
The movie that was like, what was the bulk?
Yeah, it was Return to Oz.
I swear there were lunchboxes that grew on trees.
The thing that got me was those wheeler people. Remember those wheelie people? Those were scary dudes.
Oh, no, I remember those. I used to, I don't know what, it was from, like, one of your, like, hardware kits. You had, like, some loose, like, wheels for, like, a cabinet.
Yeah.
And I used to hold them under my hands and slide into Sydney's room when she was least expecting it. And say, I'm a wheeler.
And scare your
sister.
She was
so mad. She scared the shit out of her. It was great.
Those dudes are creepy.
They were terrible. So was I.